Friends, you're listening to Irish Radio Network USA. My guest, Dr. J. Adlersberg, known to millions of viewers in New York City, New Jersey, and indeed in Connecticut, as the health and medical reporter of ABC7's award-winning Eyewitness News. Dr. J., you're very welcome.
Thank you very much, Adrian. Pleasure to be here.
We many of us, of course, who have known you through the years, have known that you are able to, you've gotten us used to taking some very complex medical conditions, and you're able to break them down into layman's language. And then, of course, we think we know everything about it. Just, when you get off the air, we say, we don't need to go to doctor at all. It's not as simple as it can be. How did you get started?
It wasn't by accident that I got it started on television. I had always been a pretty decent writer. And at one point, I was looking for something to do to not take the place of medicine, but to give me an outlet that was different from seeing patients day in and day out. And I started writing for a small newspaper out on Long Island. And one summer day, one of the producers from Channel 7 happened to be vacationing out there and wrote me and said, do you think you could do this on television? Put your medical column.
Yeah.
On TV, and one thing led to another, and I said, yes, I'd like to give it a try, and it worked out. And that was 30 years ago.
Yeah. Now, as a reporter, you have been nominated for an Emmy Award for a special report, AIDS Update. Does that kind of place a great degree of pressure on you personally? I mean, obviously, there are many updates, medical journals, reports from around the world. But when you take that kind of responsibility, what kind of pressure is that?
It's a lot of pressure. I take the job of being a medical journalist very, very seriously, and that, especially with that illness, and especially at the time that we wrote that report, which was fairly soon after the disease was really recognized, we had to go down to Washington, D.C., to the National Institutes of Health to do that report. And I went down with my producer, and we were both very, very careful to get accurate information and to try to get that information across in a minute and 30 seconds, which was about all the time we had on television for that story. And we flew back from Washington to New York on the same evening that the show was going to air. We flew back and landed in New York around 8 o'clock p.m., and the show was going to be on the 11 o'clock news that night. And we were running like chickens without heads.
Uh-huh.
Around the studio trying to get this report edited and, well, written, and I was in charge of doing the writing, in the form that would present the material without any disease mongering, without any striking fear into people.
Right.
And it all worked out, and I discovered that I worked the best under pressure. And
yeah.
It was not a big surprise to me, because that's how medicine, that's how I evolved as a doctor, but it was kind of surprising to see that it just translated immediately into the world of journalism. And I felt a lot of, we got a lot of good responses to it, and I was very proud of that report.
Now what reaction was there to, maybe within your own colleagues, to say, wait a minute, there's J. Adlersberg, and as a well-known specialist in rheumatology and whatever, and here he is crossing over into, an area that is about as far removed from rheumatology as you can guess.
You mean television?
Yes. No, I'm just saying, though, from the standpoint of researching and doing reports on AIDS, or for that matter, the many areas that you have covered over 30 years on television.
Well, you know, it's funny you should ask, but and other people have asked this, and I tell people that it breaks down exactly in half. And half of the doctors that I know say, how much can he know? He's on television. And the other half say, he must know a lot. He's on television. So I go with the second group.
Yeah.
And it depends on, I think, how much individual doctors are confident in their own practice of medicine and simply not jealous. I'll tell you something. It is not a glamorous profession, journalism. It takes a lot of hard work, and even television journalism, perhaps even more, because you can't just sit down at a computer screen with all your information in front of you and write down 1,000 words. You've got to go out and interview people. You've got to shoot video. You've got to do a lot of things,
and you've got to edit, because after all, this is your work. One imagines that if you have a lot of roughs, as they are known, you hand that over to somebody else and say, okay, now break that down into a few minutes. That's not exactly how it works, in the sense that this is your presentation, your production, and it has to, so you need to keep an eye on that as well.
Keep a very close eye on it, because no matter how many people are in the background researching and editing and producing this story, it's my face on the air, and the only thing the audience sees is my face and listens to my words. So I have to be very careful that no matter how many people are in the background, that I edit it myself very carefully, so that I give accurate and logical information to the public.
Among other things, in addition to your own private practice, you're also, a professor of medicine at Mount Sinai School of Medicine, and an attending physician at hospitals like Beth Israel, Lenox Hill, and the Hospital for Joint Diseases. So one would imagine that that's nearly enough. Having said that, in addition to being a journalist, and you've had, many, many notable stories, including the series, Are Your Pills Making You Sick? Rebuilding Your Brain. Yes, you can do something about your aches and pains. There is obviously a great spirit that you never get that far removed, from the very complex categories within the medical field. But let's ask you about your other passion. I don't think any of us would say pastime. It is a passion, one of which prompted me to invite you on in the first place, and that is you're being a still photographer and producing indeed one of the best coffee table, although it's a 300-page coffee table hardback book with 300 images of Ireland, of all places. Now, when did you begin as a still photographer? Was that before your chicken and the egg, before, during, or after?
For a
Pittsburgh guy, we might as well point that out as well.
Right. I grew up in Pittsburgh, and I came to New York about 40 years ago or so. But I've always had an interest in photography, and I did it as an avocation, as a hobby. And I mainly did it when I traveled. I loved travel, and I've traveled all my life, and I've taken a camera with me most of those times. And I put those images of all 1,000 of them, 1,000 I think, up on the internet one day, and on a website, on a photo website, Flickr.com.
Yeah.
And it turns out, unbeknownst to me, that Getty Images, the big stock photography house, the biggest in the world, oftentimes looks through Flickr photographers looking for talent. And about a year after I put these things up on the website, they called me up or emailed me, I guess, and asked if they could license a couple of my photos, and I agreed. And about a couple months later, they called me up and they said, well, we would like to license 150 of your photos. And they sent me a contract. And I thought to myself, well, this is getting beyond the hobby stage at this point.
Right. When was that, just for curiosity?
That was about I've been with Getty Images for 2 years. So it was about, that was about 3 years ago. And I was planning a trip to Ireland. My wife and I had never seen Ireland. We had heard a lot about it, had read a lot of the literature from Ireland, and knew about the politics of Ireland. I'd never been there. And I thought it was a good time to go last August. And around that time, I got an email from the publisher of Welcome Books, Lena Tabori, who Welcome is the art book house of Random House. And she said, I've noticed your photos on the internet. And where are you going next? And I emailed her back that we were going to Ireland. And she said, you know, I don't know that there's been a very good photo book from Ireland. There are a lot of attempts at it. And she actually she sent me the hardbacks that were in print. And she said, I don't like these. I think it needs a new eye. Do you want to do it? And that's how it happened. And I said, sure, I'll take my cameras with me, and I'll show you what I get, and you'll tell me whether you want to do a book. And 2 weeks in, when we came back 2 weeks later from the trip, I sent her the photos, and she said, let's go. That's how it happened.
It's not just a very new approach to the photography of Ireland, and God knows there's a ton of it that is out there. But I just want to get, how did you get past your good wife and say, by the way, you know that vacation that we're taking in Ireland?
Well,
at what point did you say, okay, I owe you one?
Both of those things. I had to say a lot of things, and I ended up owing her a trip. But she came along very willingly. She's very very relaxed, and enjoyed the trip despite the fact that I always had a camera in my hand. And I took a bunch of cameras with me and was photographing pretty much dawn till dusk. And at that time in Ireland, dusk is pretty late. So we spent the first 16 days of the trip with me on the camera and with my wife in the back reading books, talking to our driver, going into town and having a coffee, and in the meantime, we were out shooting and she was shopping. It all worked out very well. And then, of course, we went back for another 2 weeks because I brought the photos back to the publisher, and Lena said, these are wonderful. We're going to do a book. And now I want you to go back to Ireland for 2 more weeks and go to the places that you haven't been to yet and take some more photos. And I said, you talk about it as if it's a prison sentence. I don't mind.
Yeah.
And I had a wonderful, we went back for another 2 weeks. We had our same driver, Jerry Jennifer, and he took us all around to places that we hadn't been to yet. And we got another 2 weeks worth of photos. And my wife had 2 weeks to spend in Ireland doing what she wanted to do.
How did you select where to go in Ireland? And did you have something in mind?
Originally, for the first trip, the publisher and I talked, and we decided that we wanted to stay out of the big cities and away from tourist areas. Tourist sites. Tourist areas is one thing. I think all of Ireland is a beautiful tourist area, and you can spend months and months in Ireland and have a wonderful time as a tourist. But we wanted to stay away from the off the beaten path. We wanted to stay off the beaten path, and we did. We went to a lot of coastal areas, a lot of places where the tourists didn't line up, and I came back with those photos, and that's when Lena Tsibori said to me, "These are wonderful, but I think now, having thought about it for the last month, I think we have to go to some of the tourist sites and see some of the other things that everybody associates with Ireland."
Yeah.
St. Patrick's Cathedral in Dublin, the Burren. She wanted to see a distillery. And so that wasn't too bad for me either. That was high on my list as the other thing to see. And so we went, the second time I went, we went looking for tourist areas, the National Stud, the Curra Racetrack, the Newgrange.
Right.
And we went to places where tourists were attracted and where tour guides send their clients.
Right.
And we got a lot of very beautiful photos because, I should say, despite the fact that there were a lot of tourists around, I just hung back at the back of the pack. And after everyone went along into a different location in the cathedral, I would stand there for 35 or 40 seconds and snap some photos of things that were not cluttered with people in the background. And it worked out very well. Some other things that we shot, we had advanced I must say that those touristy areas, we had a lot of help from the Ireland Tourism Board here
right.
in New York City, who got us entree into places that tourists were not allowed to go in some cases, or had us come by at times when there were not very many tourists around. So, for example, we were at the long room in the old library at Trinity College about a half an hour before it opened to the public. So I was able to get some beautiful shots of the library without people around.
Right.
And a lot of the shots do have people around. It certainly is not meant to be a book of landscapes and buildings. It's meant to be about the culture of Ireland. But this particular long room in the library is such a beautiful a statement of literature and learning that I thought it was best to shoot without people scurrying around the stacks. And it worked out very well.
Let me ask you about which came first. You can open practically any page in this book here, and the photographs and all of your photographs are very unique, but they're offset to some degree by some very interesting prose and poetry. For instance, there's one, and I just happened to open it here. One of your photographs matched with William Butler Yeats' The Song of Wandering Aengus. You know, it's which came first? Did you did your photographs and then matched up many extremely well known works of poets and artists and storytellers of Ireland? Which was it?
It started out in my mind as a photo book. But when I spoke to Lena Tsibori, the publisher, about this, she said, "You know, I don't remember that there has been a book about the images of a country associated with the literature from that country and the culture of that country." And she said, "You know, the reason I was so anxious for you to photograph Ireland is because of the richness of the literature. And I want this to be a book about both." And I thought about that for a while, and I thought, first of all, what a wonderful place to take excerpts from the prose and poetry and associate them with each photo, because there were so many writers that have come out of Ireland. I don't know any other country that has four Nobel laureates in literature except for Ireland.
Right.
And then, and that doesn't even include James Joyce, and for example. And I thought, that's a great idea. And I told her so. And I went there to take photos of places that would kind of stir the soul, would bring out an emotional response, not just a isn't that pretty response.
Right.
And I traveled with not only my wife, but my stepdaughter, Samantha Bowser, who is the editor of this book. And Samantha is a senior at Sarah Lawrence College and is a writing and history major. And she is a quarter Irish. So she had, before we left, a wide understanding of Irish literature. And we, three of us, my wife and myself and Samantha, traveled together to all these places. And Samantha spent the time on her laptop computer researching the places that I was photographing. And she would say to me, Jay, there's such a beautiful place over there. And she would walk around ahead of me, mm-hmm, and say, Jay, come over here. Take a look at this. And she said, I think this really draws my interest, not just for the image, but the image means. And I would photograph that. And then she would go into the literature. She would search her mind for what she had read in the past that went with the photos. But then she would go on the internet and look even deeper for other writers who had written about this particular spot. And that's really how the book came together. So it was because of Samantha's understanding and knowledge of the writing and my photographing images that I thought were
right,
meaningful emotionally, that the book came to being.
For instance, again, as I say, open any page along the way. fabulous photograph, landscape here. And then this is offset by Speech at Tara.
Yes.
Daniel O'Connell. I tell you, you got a good team there. You know?
That particular image is of a field with sheep and plowed fields on a low mountain in the background, I think.
Right. Yes.
It was when we turned the corner on the road, and I said to our driver Jerry, I said, stop right here. And of course Jerry had his one foot on the brake and one foot on the accelerator, because every time we rounded a corner I would say, stop right here. And he did. I got
you owe him a set of brake pads as well.
Well, he got used to the fact that I would say, no, go back 30 feet. I need to get back there. And, many times he would stop the car and then I would walk 50 yards behind him in order to get to the point that I wanted to shoot from. But that was, we stopped right at the point in the road where I simply shot that image. And I thought to myself, if this doesn't spell Ireland, if this doesn't paint Ireland, I don't know what image does. And that was, I think, why Samantha picked that particular speech to go with that photo.
You know, you mentioned earlier that, you put up your 1,000 or so photographs up for the world to see for free. And that was the starting point. Do you have any regrets with respect to that first, emptying out, I'm sure, years, if not decades, of photographs, and say, my God, all right, well, I was discovered by Getty Images. That's not bad. But maybe I shouldn't have just thrown all my collection, my life collection of photo stills into the public domain.
It's a double-edged sword. I put them out there. I put them up there really so that my friends could take a look at photos, because a number of them would say to me, where did you go most recently? I know you take photos. Where are they? And I could say, go to that website. And then, of course, Getty came along, and I was unprepared. I really was unprepared. I didn't do it for that reason.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't put them up there for that reason. But it it happened, and I thought to myself, well, if I ever want to take those photos and put them into a book of some kind or a calendar, I still can do it. I will just take them out of Getty's portfolio and use them for myself. On the other hand, I looked at it and I thought to myself, my goodness, I wonder if this had gotten started sooner, would it have meant a different, would I have taken a different road in my life someplace?
Well, you definitely, however it happened, you wound up with the best of both. Also, some of your clients, New York Times, Microsoft, you know, Saatchi & Saatchi, Macmillan Publishing, you're up there.
I guess that's what happened when you sign a contract with the Getty Images. Because the people that peruse Getty's files are substantive. And the thing that I the first of those images was from Microsoft, and Getty wrote me they have a tally at the end of each month of what sold. And Microsoft bought an image of a sea lion sunning itself on the beach in the Galapagos Islands with this bright aqua water behind it, and they used it as wallpaper on the computer screen.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought to myself, I guess, as Sally Field said when she accepted an Academy Award, they like me, they really like me. And it came one thing after another over a few months, and the New York Times bought a photo that I took in Costa Rica of a howler monkey. And I must say that photo was one of the nicest of any animal or bird I had ever shot. And it really said something. The monkey had almost a human expression on its face. And I thought to myself, that's why the Times picked that, because, you know, on Getty, there must be 1,000 photos of howler monkeys taken by different photographers. And the Times went through them, and they picked mine. And I don't know why, except that I guess it looked like a face staring back at you, human face.
I want to come back to the... Although it's hard to know which your actual day job is at this stage of the game, but let's go to the television and WABC and the news team, and how demanding is that? You know, considering you've been, you know, around almost as long as myself in the media business, to pick a topic, to take some of the, you know, numerous medical research items, and to choose which is the more appropriate one for the time that's in it, for the month, for the year, whatever it is that's in it. How do you get around making different presentations of some topics that won't go away? Obviously, cancer. Do you find yourself taking on some of the news headline research journals from around the world?
Yes, all the time. It is a very rigorous. As I say, the doctors that say how much can he know? He's on television. Don't consider the fact that TV is not, as I said, it's not glamorous. It's a lot of work, and a lot of that work is covering big stories in the medical literature, not just one that comes to mind that everyone could associate with, which was toenail fungus, which has got the most response of any story we've ever put on the air, but stories that are in the New England Journal of Medicine, for example, that are breakthrough stories about cancer treatments. We never shy away from those things, one of my jobs is to read through those journals and see if a particular item is one, life-changing for patients and doctors, and two, explainable in a minute and 30 seconds. But you know what? That's what they pay me for,
right,
to put these complex things into understandable language and pictures and drawings. And that's that's the biggest part of my job, is going through all the things that come across my desk and picking which ones are news, number one,
right,
and big news, number two.
Would you blame some of those, including obviously the millions who've already seen your own reports, for thinking that there was a period of time where, say, the New England Journal of Medicine, where something that came from there was much more credible than the, you know, the multitude of reports that come in from various, well, sounding, if we don't know that much about it, medical fields and journals from around the place, that there are some who within, you know, the same 6 month period would have conflicting reports. And how do you look at those, or do you just, you know, flick through them and say, this is not my job?
Not at all. I think the most important job of a medical journalist is to put things in perspective, to put science in perspective for the layperson. That science is three steps forward and two steps backward kind of a process. And there will be reports that come out that do conflict with other reports that come out later. And it's my job to have the audience understand that that's what science is. That's what research is. If you knew what you were going to find, it wouldn't be research. So people have to, the scientists have to go forward and announce in paper, in journals or online now, what they've discovered. And sometimes it's not correct. Sometimes it is. But the following report is not correct. The audience has to know that they have to, in a way, take some of these things with a grain of salt and wait until a report is confirmed, or wait until the information in the journal comes into medical practice, and then they know it's accurate and that the facts are indeed what this article pointed them out to be. It's not easy for the public, because they say, "Oh, but last week you told me that coffee causes cancer. Now you're telling me it's good for you." But that the job of the reporter, of my job as I see it, is to put that into context and say, listen, understand that none of these reports are perfect, and put them in your pipe and smoke it.
Right.
And then the next thing that comes along, do the same. And the third thing that comes along, see if it backs up one of the two.
Yeah.
And that is the hardest thing for me to tell whether I've gotten that point across. And if I get emails from the audience that say, you know, I realized that last week coffee could kill you and now it's good for you, but what you told me made sense. Just take it with a grain of salt until we see what the next report says.
For those who don't know or who don't get to watch my guest on WABC 7 as the medical reporter and expert, I would say that you can actually, if you log on in this day and age, it's not that difficult to most of these reports are indeed archived and online. What you don't need to do is to pass any judgment on this famous doctor here, my guest, if you pick up a copy of the book, because I guarantee you that this will not be, you know, I doubt if anybody who sees this book will find any criticism in it. It's new, it's fresh, and as I say, we were not short of coffee book, either photography or otherwise of Ireland, but this one incorporates both. And I think that Tourism Ireland did a good job in pointing you or helping you out in the direction. It's fantastic.
So, thank you.
All right, so let's talk about how to get it. It's a heavy book, by the way.
Yes, my wife says don't drop it on your toe.
Don't carry them around as Christmas presents either in your satchel.
It is. So there was a review in the Los Angeles Times gift guide last week that said it's the size of a serving tray, and it's a big book. It is truly a coffee table book. But what they also said in the review was that the size of the photos makes them even more impressive and makes the places jump out and feel real to you when you see them. It is a big book. It's available any place. What do they say? In any place good books are sold. It's on Amazon and Barnes & Noble and certainly in the local bookstores now.
Ireland in word and image and photographs by J. Ben Adlerberg. And you don't use your doctor title in this in the promotion of the book anyway. Was that intentional? Or?
That was intentional. I didn't think it mattered to the reader whether I was a doctor or not when I had a camera in my hand. As a matter of fact, that the photo on the inside flap of the jacket of the book of me standing there in a pair of what looked like work clothes was essentially what it was like for those 30 days of taking photos. I didn't look very much like a doctor. I remember reading one of the newspapers here never used his a medical reporter didn't use his MD at the end of his byline. I one time asked him about it, and he said, "Well, you know, I'm writing as a journalist. I know about medicine, and I'm writing about medicine. But people are reading this because I'm a journalist, not necessarily because I'm a doctor." And I thought about that when I did the book, and I thought what I would do, however, is use my middle name, Ben. People don't know me as Dr. J. Ben Adlersberg; they know me as Dr. J. Adlersberg. But Ben was not just a middle name; it was part of my first name, really. It was like Mary Lou or Mary Louise.
Yeah.
J. Ben is what my family still calls me.
Yes.
And when I meet an old friend on the street or get a phone call, they always say, "J. Ben, how are you?" And so that's how that came about. And I thought it was a tribute to my family and my parents, particularly, of whom I'm very proud. And that's why I used that name.
Thank you for spending the time with us. It's Welcome Books, friends, for those, and it's distributed by Random House. www.welcomebooks.com and then /Ireland will get you to it. There's a contact number here. I'm not too sure who Andy is, Andy Reynolds, but he gives his number here is 212-989-3200. If he's annoyed by callers, then you should tell him that he shouldn't have put his number on the press kit and not insert in brackets private.
I didn't realize that.
Good luck. Dr. Adlersberg, Ben. Thank you. And friends, you're listening to Irish Radio Network, USA.